Good evening, everyone. I'm really delighted to see each of you, to that you came, that you chose to devote these precious moments of your day to sitting together and sharing here on this, our Zoom Zendo. If I haven't already met you or heard or exchanged emails with you, I wish you a very bountiful and healthy and rich New Year, wherever you are. Looking at the screen like this and seeing all these different faces, rooms, cities, countries, nationalities, languages, continents. I immediately think of the line from the Diamond Sutra that is dwelling in nowhere or dwelling in no place, raise the body mind. And when we dwell in nowhere, when we dwell in no place, then everywhere is it. Everywhere is the place. Everywhere is here. And raising the body mind, the mind, the body mind is the mind that that seeks awakening for both oneself and for others. And so if we don't dwell in any one place, then everyone we meet and everywhere we go is the place of raising the body mind, and we wish that awakening for every person we meet. We chant this conceivably impossible vow of, sentient beings are numberless, I vow to save them. But that just means that doesn't mean every single one in the universe. It means every single one in the universe is worthy of your attention, is worthy of your unconditional love, to awaken, and your wishes for them are to awaken as it is for yourself. So I look at this screen and we can't dwell in any one place or we wouldn't be able to see the others. If we focus, sometimes we put it on speaker view, maybe you have it on speaker view at the moment, but I choose not to do that because then I can see everyone equally. Whereas if I click speaker view, then I only see the one who's talking big, and I don't see everyone else the same size. Sometimes in these kinds of situations where one person is talking, you may prefer to put it on speaker view. Or when I do online Dokusan, I prefer to put it on speaker view so that the one who I'm talking to is big and I am small, because it's not about me. So all of this to say that I'm delighted that you're here, and it seems like a long time since we last met, although it was only a few weeks. Much has probably happened for all of us in that time. Some were not present a few weeks ago. Others were and were doing different things, whatever. I today was the funeral for Jimmy Carter, the former US president, who I realized, it's quite incredible. He was president 50 years ago, elected president in 1976, which a long time ago. And I don't know how much in Europe you're familiar with him, but he was quite an extraordinary, not really an extraordinary president. Although the fact that he was not an extraordinary president makes him an extraordinary president. But he had an extraordinary life and did extraordinary things as a great bodhisattva throughout his life. And so I watched a bit of the funeral today, and what struck me was that He was the values that animated his spirit were never left him. When he was president, he was a nuclear engineer in the Navy. He was a entrepreneur, he was a farmer, he was a father, husband, grandfather, great grandfather, politician briefly. He was a Southern white male who was militant for civil rights. A lot of seeming contradictions. But what animated his spirit throughout his life was the spiritual. He was a deep Christian. He had deep Christian faith. But in the, his creed was to love his neighbor, love thy neighbor like yourself, right? Which is not other than our, guiding experience of oneness where I and the other are one. As we say, when we awaken to awakening is nothing other than seeing the oneness of life. So he moved through the world with this endless, constant attention, awareness of oneness. He saw everyone he met as worthy. He took his whatever the domain he was working in, he was animated by that spirit. So he was a nuclear engineer who worked for peace. He was a white Southerner who worked for the freedom of and equal rights for Black people. He was, a church man. He taught Sunday school every Sunday. And yet he, went to the White House and lived the politician's life for 4 years. Before that, he was a governor for 4 years. But the 96 other years of his life were devoted to other things, right? And I say this just because it's very inspiring to know that it's possible what he did. It's possible to move in the world, not losing sight of our values, whatever we want to call values, not losing sight of the absolute in the relative world, because that's what it amounts to, right? The sixth patriarch in our tradition, in China in the 7th century, I think, was this illiterate wood chopper, and heard someone in a marketplace say this line that I quoted to you from the Diamond Sutra, dwelling in nowhere, raise the body mind, and had a deep realization. But he didn't stop there. He realized that, penetrating the absolute, that seeing this nowhere, he needed to put that realization into his daily life. So, like Jimmy Carter put his realization, I don't know what his realization of Christ and the Christian faith was. Something probably very deep, though, around, love thyself, love others like yourself, love thy neighbor like yourself. And he The sixth patriarch then went off to, he became the sixth patriarch. He went off to study with a teacher because he realized that this realization he had, he needed to actualize it and bring it into daily life. And he wasn't ready to do that. He didn't see how to do that. So he pursued a path of study and practice with a teacher. And he went on then, we won't go into the sixth patriarch's life, but he went on to become who, the person that we call the sixth patriarch. Although he was illiterate and supposedly illiterate, there's some controversy about that, and not a monk. So, those of most of us in the Wildflower Sangha, I mean, everyone in the Wildflower Sangha is not a monk. We're all lay people and we live secular lives. And so our challenge is, How do we bring this practice into our life? How do we live this practice every day? In our interactions with family, friends, colleagues, wherever we are, not dwelling anywhere, therefore able to meet whatever arises with an open heart. That's the challenge. And we have a special feeling, in the past few days for the people in Los Angeles, because two of our members, one who Christine is not here, but her brother, lost his house in the fires, and was able to flee with his daughter and is safe, but had lost everything. And then someone else, Marjolaine, said that her cousin, also lives in that area and was threatened, but fortunately for the moment is safe and has not had to evacuate. That is a real challenge, though, isn't it? How can we dwell in nowhere and raise the body mind in a situation like that, where the fire is roaring over the hill, where your house is burning down? That's a challenge, right? And yet, it just means this, dwelling in nowhere, raise the body mind. It just means to fully accept reality as it is. So, surrender, it's a deep surrender of your whole being to just this. And when you do that, then you know what to do. And you know what compassion is. So, we are exchanging about this in the past few days, exchanging about these people losing their homes and reading the news. And it's hard for us to, as some people have said, we can't really know what they're experiencing. No, because we're not experiencing that. But we can share what we know of suffering, we can share what we know of loss. We can share what we know of uncertainty, of pain, of fear. We can share what we know of that and respond with compassion without saying, yes, my house has burned. Although, as Bernie Glassman liked to say, that house that burned is his house, which is true. He wasn't talking about the fires. He was saying, the cars in the car dealership are his. He didn't need a Porsche. He had plenty of Porsches in the car dealership. So the houses that burned, those are our houses. The people who have no shelter, that's us. Can we take them into our hearts? Can we respond with love, all embracing love? Because ultimately, that's what it's about. Can we operate with, or can we say, a tough mind and a tender heart, let's say. Someone said something like that. I don't think it was exactly that, but something like that at Carter's funeral, that, that's how he moved in the world, with a tough mind and a tender heart. The tough mind is the equivalent of wisdom, of, clear view of things as they are, without judgment. And that allows us then to have a tender heart. So we can have a tender heart for these people in California who are losing their homes and their livelihoods, and their some people have died, and maybe pets have died. I heard that they were encouraging people, as if they fled, to leave out bowls of, containers of water for animals that maybe weren't able to come with them, or who were in the forests who were burning. It's not just people. The sentient beings are all beings, right? It's not just people. Can we act with, awareness, clear clarity, things as they are, not clouded by judgment? And then with tender heart, or as someone said at the retreat I was at just last week, skillful tenderness was it? Skillful tenderness. That's the functioning of wisdom, is the tenderness, the compassion. When we see things clearly as they are, when we see the oneness, then we can act with skillful tenderness, with an open heart that is filled with unconditional love. Unconditional because there are no conditions on it. It's for everyone, it's for everything. Someone told a story at Carter's funeral about, so he was from this little town in Georgia, this tiny little place called Plains, Georgia, and was in a county that was majority black. So Mark, Carter being a white man, the white community was a minority. But the sheriff of that town, of that county, was a white man and was terrible, apparently. Was ruthless with the black people, was racist. And when Andrew Young, who was one of who worked with first with Martin Luther King and then with Carter, and he told this story today, said that when he first met Carter when he was running for governor of Georgia, he said, "Oh, I hear you're from Plains, Georgia." And Carter said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Well, the only person I've heard of from there is this sheriff." And Andrew Young was a black man, is a black man, and said that he's pretty bad. That's the only person I've heard of from there. And Carter said, "Oh yeah, he's one of my good friends." Well, so Jimmy Carter did not share the values of this horrible sheriff, but he welcomed him into his circle as he would anyone else. And by doing that, he could act change. He could change things by doing that, by welcoming everyone with unconditional love. I don't know if he changed the mind of that terrible sheriff. I don't know the rest of the story, but it certainly changed Andrew Young's mind about Jimmy Carter. And he joined forces with him and said to this day, it's a miracle that anybody from Plains, Georgia became president of the United States, given the dynamics of politics in America. It's just that's Jimmy Carter's manifestation of tough mind, tender heart. Lucidly seeing things as they are. So our challenge, is to make real our vows, our bodhisattva vows. Even those of you who have not received Jukai and haven't re take formally taken the vows, you're on this path. And this path is about awakening to oneness and unconditional love and displaying unconditional love. So how do we manifest those values in this real world? How do we always talk about the relative and the absolute. Well, so in this relative world, how do we manifest the absolute? How do we make them one? They are one. There isn't those are, apparently two different aspects of reality, but actually they're one. They're always manifesting at the same time. It's like you are it. You are mu, you are one, but you don't realize it. You are Buddha, but you don't realize it. It doesn't mean that you're not Buddha just because you don't realize it. It just means that you don't realize that you're Buddha, So our path is, that's what it is. It's to awaken first to that, that you and all are Buddha. Know, like the Buddha's his own awakening of, seeing that star, that morning star, and suddenly realizing, oh, everyone, everywhere, simultaneously, he's not dwelling anywhere. He's dwelling in nowhere. Everybody is awake, simultaneously is awakened. He didn't see that before, which would that was his struggle. When we don't see that, then we struggle. He sees that and immediately, oh, wow. The struggle is over. What a great relief. He could have, felt sorry for himself and he said, oh, everybody else knew this already and I didn't. I came late to the party, as I like to say. He didn't say that. He was overjoyed. He said, how wonderful that everyone was awake. Everyone, of course, they don't know they're awake. They don't see their awakened nature. We don't see it, but doesn't mean that that's not our nature. And when you see it, then that changes everything of how you move in the world, how you interact with one another, how you, what is your aim? What is your intention? Is your intention to cultivate love and compassion and wisdom, or is your aim to accumulate wealth and stay young, forever young, and I don't know, chase migrants out of your town? Those are two extremes, right? I'm giving these like really extreme examples. It's actually much more subtle than that. The choices we make and what we choose to function, to focus on, right? One of the, one of the interesting stories from Jimmy Carter's life is that he, so after he was no longer president, he created a foundation, and a center, and devoted himself to, giving all of his intention and effort and resources to people who were in unfavorable places and positions in life. So he built houses for the poor, built houses for people who didn't have them or couldn't afford them. He, worked to bring peace and negotiate peace settlements. He went to monitor elections in countries where they, there might be corruption. And he focused on healthcare and in disfavored countries, right? He and his, I heard today from his grandson that he, his efforts, his the center, managed to almost completely eradicate a disease in Africa. That the, before there were, when he started this, there were millions of people in Africa who had this, it's called Guinea worm disease. And last year, there were only 14 cases detected out of millions, say 25 years ago. And the way he did this was to go into the communities, the small villages, not him personally himself all the time, but his people that worked for him, and teach the villages how to have clean water, how to protect their water sources so that this disease would not be transmitted, because it's transmitted by amoeba in stagnant water, and then it gets into the intestines and a worm grows and it's very bad. And if people who have it are in contact with water, then they contaminate the water again. And it's, of course, it's interconnected, right? It's all interdependent, as we know from our practice. So they taught the people in the villages how to how to behave with this disease without any vaccine or medicine. There is no vaccine or medicine for this disease, apparently, but they've managed to eradicate it just by teaching people how to teach other people to teach other people. And so now all of these villages, these little tiny villagers, are populated by Jimmy Carter, by millions of Jimmy Carters. Of course, they're just embodying the values and the intentions that he brought to their villages. And it's almost completely eradicated this disease. Absolutely incredible, just from go meeting people where they are. With a tough mind, seeing, well, what is the cause? Like the Buddha, what is the cause of the suffering? What is the cause of the disease? And with a clear mind, seeing, ah, going to these places already because of animated by this spirit of love, unconditional love. These people are as worthy of love as the people in his town, in his country. And, teaching them to teach each other and to save their own communities and comrades in their communities. And then Jimmy Carter's people, they can go away. They've done their work. They've taught people how to teach themselves, which in a sense is what our Zen path is about too, Somebody sits here like me and, just talks and talks and talks and, doesn't really say anything and doesn't really mean anything unless it means something, unless there's a resonance in your heart. And then, okay, and then you s experience something for yourself and then you tell other people. There's nothing that is outside of us, in other words. It's not like something outside of you is going to be realized. All you will be realizing is yourself. And then you help other people realize themselves. At this retreat where I was at the New Year, which was a transmission retreat from my Dharma brother Frank, giving transmission for the first time to his student. And I had to sit on a panel with my two of my Dharma brothers, Michel Olteitan sensei and João Rodrigues sensei. And they asked us to say just a little something about transmission and then people ask questions. So one of the first questions that was asked was, so when did you know that you wanted to do this, that you wanted to be, a Zen teacher and receive transmission and create a sangha and do all this. What happened that, when did you know? So because I'm the oldest, I always had to answer the questions first. And so I said, well, I'm going to disappoint you because it's not like what you think for me. For me, from the moment I first learned to sit, I just wanted to share it with other people. I just wanted to sit with other people and share the experience that I loved so much from sitting, from Zazen, from meditation, whatever you want to call it. And I didn't know anybody who did it, and I wanted to know other people so I could share. And I wanted to find a teacher who knew something more about it so that I could exchange with her and develop it and find other people who did it too. And then as I went along, that didn't change. That was still the same. I was always animated by that spirit of just wanting to share. And so then I became my teacher's Jisha for many years. And as I've told before, when I would I was the Jisha, so I was always the last one into the Zendo. Went in after her. Everyone else was already sitting down. She went into the Zendo and I followed her. And every time I would come in, I would be like tonight, just absolutely delighted that people were there. I just would say, oh, they came. They're here. It's like tonight I connect and I'm like, oh, they came. They're here. Just this utter joy of sharing it with others. And then as I went along and my teacher asked me to give a talk, I didn't want to give a talk. I hated giving talks. I hated talking in front of other people. Even, when there would be a situation like this and people would ask questions and there would be exchanges, I never talked when she was taught, when my teacher was talking. Never. But that was the way that my teacher asked me to share my experience. And I said, okay, I just want to share, so I'll do it. And then she asked me to, see people in interviews. Okay, I didn't want to do that either, but that was the vehicle to share with. And then received Dharma transmission. I don't know if I really wanted that, but that was the vehicle to share. This is just an example of, it's not that, we all will have that same experience, but in some way, if you really look into your heart, you will find what it is that animates your path. And it's probably not to become some great, world-renowned guru or something. If you really look into it, I saw this film Conclave recently where there's a pope who dies and they have to select a new pope. And the guy who's running it, who's running the conclave says, for him, the one who should be pope is the one who doesn't want it. And it actually ends up kind of happening that way. But we see throughout the film how much all these other guys really want it. If we really look into our hearts, what is it that animates our path? Is it a desire to raise the body mind? And for whom? Of course, for ourself, right? We want to awaken ourselves. But ultimately, it means nothing if we don't move into the world with it, if we don't interact and help others to raise the body mind. It doesn't mean anything. It's a dead end, something like that. So, tonight I was, animated by, compassion for the all of the people, suffering from the fires. It's interesting that the media talks so much about the famous people who lost their homes, but there's so many people who have lost so much, who nobody is paying any attention to. Of course, people are, but they really want to know, oh, which movie stars lost their homes? Which comes from a desire to maybe, I would like to think, realize that the celebrities, people are just humans like the rest of us. There's nothing special about them. They too can lose their homes in a catastrophic fire. I would like to think that when we're worried about celebrities losing their homes, it's coming from a space like that, where we also have compassion for them, but not losing sight of the individuals like Christine's brother and hundreds of others, million, thousands of others, I think, have lost their homes. So I was, apparently when Jimmy Carter, he every Sunday he taught Sunday school, and his grandson used to go with him. And said that he always started the Sunday school class. First, he would, scope out the room. Apparently, before dawn, there was a line of people waiting to get into the church for the Sunday school. And then, when they got in and they sat down, he would ask, and almost all of the people came from somewhere else. From another city, another state, another country. They all came there for Jimmy Carter's Sunday school. And that His grandson said he always started out the Sunday school by talking about his own life, whatever was happening in his life at the moment. That was his way of bringing the absolute, the relative, making the relative absolute. So, and then he would probably go into some kind of scripture and story of Jesus's life or something that applied to the real, the reality of his life as it was. And I thought, oh, I can relate to that, you know, that's very much of how I experience the Dharma. It manifests here and now in all of our lives. And that's what's important. You know, I don't need to sit down and, you know, read to you from a book. It means nothing. It means nothing. So, talked for a long time. Questions, comments, sharing of any kind from if anyone would like to participate. It's always great to hear from you.
Hey, just a silly question. Was Trump attending the funeral?
He was.
Oh.
All of the former living presidents and their wives, and the actual president and vice president, and the former vice presidents who are alive were there. And there was it was remarked upon the fact that only one president from the 20th century was there. All of the others are from the 21st century, which is quite astounding. Bill Clinton was the only one from 20th century.
Hello, everybody. What is a Sunday school, Roshi? What is the Sunday school? What is that?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the Protestant church, it's similar to catechism.
Okay.
You know, it's except it's not only for children. It can be for children. You know, children go to the Sunday school often when the ceremony, you know, the sermon and things are going on in the church proper. But you know, it's like a moment of teaching. It's like a class, usually about some biblical story or. You know, kind of like this, you know, where you sit down and you hear about the Dharma and then talk about it. He's probably the only president in the history of the United States who taught Sunday school. I don't know, but probably the only one. And I don't think probably any. Well, maybe in some in Portugal and France, there were some who taught catechism, but I doubt it. I really doubt it.
I believe that when we are able, let's say, to speak from the heart or to care, to really care about our neighbors or about the other. I believe that it depends very much in what we live, in what is our experience of every day. I say that because I have been this holiday in a very far and little village up in the north, and I haven't had that experience for a long time. And in this very little village, the primordial things and beings are very present. I mean, there are animals, we see very much of the sky, we see the mountains, the doors are not really closed. And that make me feel, well, it was very little time, but I felt different when I came back to Lisbon. And very quickly I had a experience of the opposite of what I have just had in this village. So I went into the metro and there was a fight inside the metro between a black man and a white man. And they were just beating each other, you know, really hard. Usually I would just run away and defend myself for being also beat. But that day, I begin to scream and say, "Stop that!" And then I begin to make gestures. And I, when the metro stopped in a station, I saw a policeman. I took the policeman inside the metro, and he separated the two men. And then he took one of them out of the metro, and the metro go on. And the other one, he still went on saying bad words and things like that. And I still had told him, "Shut up." And I said, it was not me that is speaking, you know, it's someone else, because I couldn't believe that I was doing that. But really, I think it is because I had that experience of this environment so difficult, so different that I usually live in town, in my street, and in most of the places I go through. Then I thought, well, maybe when I go out the metro, this man is going to follow me and I'm going to be beaten also. But nothing that happened.
Thank you, Anna. Yeah, beautiful story. We could say that when you go into a different environment and a different situation and you focus on different things, like we do in retreat, for example, we let go of our usual positions and beliefs and obstacles about within ourselves, even, you know. We open to things as they are. We open to just being without all that stuff that we're clogged with. So then when we go into back into our usual environment, all of that stuff we forgot, we've forgotten about all the usual ways of behaving, all the usual metro etiquette of not looking, not saying, running away, fear, all of that. And we're able to then just respond to the situation. Of course, it doesn't last. Probably now it's faded somewhat. But it's important to have that experience and realize, oh, yeah, this is possible. That's why we go into retreats, is to have that kind of experience of like you have when you go out into a small village and tiny insects and quiet and completely different. People leave their window, their doors unlocked. That's really in a big city, you would not do that, And then that changes you, like you say. Yeah, that's a good experience to remember. Of course, we do have to have some kind of discernment to know when we might put ourselves in danger. Like you say, he might have, hit you. Probably something in you realized that that was not going to happen. Without you being aware of it. I don't know. Great. That's a bodhisattva.
It seems a good example of being nowhere. Like you said, I don't remember the exact line, being nowhere or and being no one, being what's appropriate in this circumstance. Yeah.
Dwelling in nowhere. So,
Dwelling nowhere.
yeah, exactly. So, when you're in the metro, you're not dwelling and being in the small village where people leave their doors open, but you're also not dwelling and being in the metro and all of this stuff that you have about being in the metro or being in the countryside. You're nowhere. You're just here. And you react then, you respond to the situation. Yeah.
I think also it's very much about fear. And fear makes us very different. It modifies us very much.
Absolutely. That's one of the great obstacles we have to just being, just acting, just responding. And fear is related to, having ideas about the situation. So, what might happen, hanging on to what has happened, projecting to what might happen instead of just being present to the situation.
I still remember when I had no fear, some years and years and years and years ago. I
And
think
did you
I
like
had no
that?
fear, but now I have.
Yeah. Well, and in that moment when you acted in the metro, did you have fear?
No.
Right. So you
Just
know
after.
exactly, fear is after. So that is possible, that is accessible, that experience of having no fear. Krisha, you wanted to say something?
Yes. Hi, everyone. Happy 2020,000. Yeah, I wanted to say, but I really resonated with all what you were talking. I didn't want it to talk about it. Of course, I didn't know what were you were going to talk, but yeah, especially now about the fear, I really can see myself. Especially when I was young and a child and young and no fear, and the fear growing up as long as I'm getting older. And yeah, and those moments that you can or they let go spontaneously, or even being in the countryside and saying good morning to everyone and returning to Lisbon, doing the same, and everybody looks at you. But yeah, it really happens. Although I do smile a lot and people smile back in Lisbon, but I don't say good morning usually. So almost like I'm a crazy person reaction. But what I was about the talk and our path, and what came to me, it's about my most beloved instruments that are every day and every time in front of me, in my face and in my heart, wherever. It's my children, of course, and unconditional love, and how much of it is true for me. I think, of course, I love them. But I really love them, you know. Conditional love, they really teach me about that, because kids, and I think mine are still a bit young, but they are already 14 and 11, so they can have a different taste of you and go do things you really don't like, and you really think it's lame or bad or whatever, but they like it. And I really grow happy. I really enjoy seeing them. It's really unconditional. Like, I don't know, examples. I loved a lot ballet. Both of them made it. Both of them quit it, and one went to gymnastics. I hate gymnastics music. I think it's awful. And I thought, oh, what a pity the classical education, and me still remembering when dancing, trying to dance with us, anything with them, anything of this will never happen because they don't have it. But I really love and really appreciate it. Their choices, even though they are different of me, of mine. And I feel that space in me. And I think it's quite beautiful, and sometimes strikes me. It's almost like I don't even have to let go. I really love them unconditional, in an unconditional way. And I think it's the first time in my life that really happened. And of course, I try to touch that feeling, among other persons, and more likable. Likely other situations, you know, the situations that I don't like, or I can judge a person, or I don't think the person is whatever, and really try to try the loving and compassionate way and not feel the difference. Even if I don't understand it. And by now, I think it's a good moment in the practice for me, I think. Moment in the sense of a way to the practice. But still, and this I don't understand, and this is about myself. Uncompassion and loving about my own person. It's there, of course, but it's sometimes it feels, I don't quite understand, but like there is a holiness or a grace that that it's not available for me. Don't know. I don't know what it means, because I like a lot of having good stuff, good practice, growing up, blah 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 blah, blah. But it's almost, I don't know. I think it's a belief. It's and I don't quite get it. I was thinking of that when I thought of talking with you and share this, and this is what I have to share. Thank you.
Thank you. So you know, you say it's a belief. Absolutely. Absolutely. And you say you don't know what to do about it. There, you know, the we can say what we can do is just to realize that it's a belief and stay with, okay, it's just a belief. A belief has no substance. And when we can see through it, when we can see through that it's empty nature, it's nothing, it's just like a cloud, then you may realize something. I can't tell you what, but the fact that you were aware that it's a belief, or you suggest it might be, that's important. We're almost out of time, people. I'm sorry. You know, if we could all, like, Krisha tells the story of how she approaches her, how she experiences her children and not agreeing with their choices, but still loving them. Imagine the world if we all did that with one another, you know? If we went to, you know, if we crossed the aisle, as we say, to people who don't have the same political beliefs or the spiritual beliefs or the color or speak the same language or whatever, if imagine if we could receive people in that same way, like we do our children, or we hope we do our children, or as Krisha does with her children. That's an aspiration we can have. That would change the world, actually. It would change the way that you relate to people in any case, and that changes the world. We're out of time. Thank you all for coming. We'll chant the vows, I guess. I'm not sure who's in charge, but thank you.